Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You know, we're trying not to do a segment every time Donald Trump makes a provocative tweet. It's a cheap high, often without much substance. But when he tweets about a new nuclear arms race, as he did yesterday, and then backs it up with a statement to the media this morning, we thought we kind of have to. But we'll try to make it really substantive by bringing on an expert in the history of our nuclear arms control treaties with Russia. He is Fred Kaplan, War Stories columnist for Slate. Among his books is The Wizards of Armageddon, which dates to the 80s during the Cold War, and which won a Pulitzer Prize at the time and was all about U.S.-Soviet nuclear relationships. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. I have to correct you.
Okay.
I won a Pulitzer Prize then, but for something else. It wasn't for the book.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that. I actually bought that book in the 1980s, long before I ever met you professionally.
Oh, well, thank you. You were one of the few.
I helped fund your life, and I learned a lot from it at the time. This started yesterday, first by way of background for people who don't know the story, when Vladimir Putin said something in a speech to his military leaders about strengthening Russia's nuclear capability. Trump responded on Twitter that the U.S. should expand its nuclear capability. Then Trump's spokespeople seemed to tamp that down and put it in the context of arms control. But then this morning, Trump said to Mika Brzezinski, co-host of MSNBC's Morning Joe, in a phone call, according to her, "Let it be an arms race. We will outmatch them at every pass." Let's start here. Can you put Putin's original Thursday comment in context? I've heard a report that says he says things like that routinely about strengthening his nuclear capability, and he was not making new policy.
Yes, that's true. As I understand it, this was part of his annual three-hour press conference with the Russian people, and most of which deals with domestic politics. He was asked about this. He has said many times that if the United States is going to build a missile defense system, in other words, a system designed to shoot down Russian missiles as they come across the horizon, then he will build more weapons or special weapons that can evade those defenses. He has said that many times. Has he done that yet? No. Is he building a lot of new nuclear weapons? Yeah, he is. I mean, not in addition to those that he has, but to replace older ones. Now, Trump says we need to strengthen and expand our nuclear capability. Now, what does that mean? I looked at this. You know, what does he mean? But first of all,
he said until the world comes to its senses on nuclear weapons.
Yes,
right?
Yes. So, what do those two things mean? And I think let's have a little experiment here. Let's do what the Trump people tell us all the time not to do. Let's take those words seriously and literally. Okay. Let's act for just one moment as if this is somebody who doesn't, you know, tweet by reflex, and then let's pretend that there was some thought that went into this. We're doing this already. I mean, expanding nuclear capability does not necessarily mean expanding the number of weapons, the arsenals, the power. President Obama approved quite some time ago the perpetuation of a nuclear, quote, modernization program that improves the reliability of these weapons, the durability of the command control mechanisms that make sure they actually launch if the president pushes a button. We're spending something like $30 billion a year on this sort of thing, keeping the nuclear labs going, keeping nuclear materials going. So in one sense, this has been going on. Now, in terms of until the world comes to its senses, now, I don't know, what does this mean? Does this mean until the world buckles down to American dominance, until the world, you know, something that people like you and me might say, comes to its senses and gets rid of these damn things? I don't know. know. I don't know. Is it worth really examining? I mean, New York Times has this big thing taking up practically an entire page parsing this tweet as if it were some kind of Talmudic text. Yeah, I don't think he gave it that much thought. I don't know if it's worth that much analysis. But to the extent that it does, assuming, taking the premise that it does, it's neither of these statements are necessarily alarming.
Putin responded to Trump, if I'm getting the timeline right, by saying Russia is stronger than any potential aggressor.
Yeah.
And then Trump responded to that this morning to Mika Brzezinski, according to her, let it be an arms race. We'll outmatch them at every pass.
Yeah. Now, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of interesting, Brian, isn't it, that Trump is kind of pushing back against Putin? That's kind of interesting. Is this foreboding of things to come as they size each other up? Are they just, you know, pacing around each other like contestants in a wrestling match? I mean, there used to be this kind of rhetorical back and forth all the time. It is a little disturbing that it's taking place in the nuclear realm, like the good old days that Trump wants to return to when we were great again, right? But this let it be an arms race. All right. Now, if I would have preferred if he had said something like, hey, if he wants to get into an arms race, we're going to win. We have more money. We have more capability. We can do this. But wouldn't it be better if we all kind of tamper this thing down and even reduce these crazy weapons to an even lower degree since? I wouldn't. To me, this is not page one news. All right. And if it is page one news, I think it deserves a little bit more historical context. It is true, you know, when I got into this field, when I was a mere wee boy in knee pants, this was all anybody talked about in terms of U.S.-Russian relations. What's the ratio of our warheads? What's the ratio of our missile throw weight? Who's ahead in the arms race? It was all tokens. It was arms control negotiations. That was all U.S. and Russians talked about when they got together. Now, this was because it was during the Cold War, and there was no political opportunity to talk about anything else. These things were bargaining chips. They were tokens of strength. The negotiations themselves were tokens of diplomacy. Most of these treaties, with a few notable exceptions, had no real effect on anything. They were surrogates for diplomacy. Now we are grown-ups in a world unfrozen from the Cold War when we can talk about real things and have conflicts over real issues and real wars. And, yeah, it is kind of disturbing to find ourselves thrust into this wormhole back in time when all this symbolic nonsense was going on. And, by the way, these are symbols that can still blow up the entire world.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this concern about the tweets is also, I mean, let's face it, it's also another delayed shock and reaction to the fact that Donald Trump will soon be president, where he, like all other presidents, has exclusive control over the magic button that can launch these weapons at a moment's notice.
My guest is Fred Kaplan, Slate's War Stories columnist. And listeners, as we now pivot from talking about the actual stagecraft between Putin and Trump, maybe this stagecraft ends the bromance, I don't know, over the last day or so, we're going to talk about the history of U.S.-Russia and U.S.-Soviet nuclear arms control treaties and in what context any of this tweeting or taunting back and forth can even legally exist. And listeners, if you have any questions about the international treaty status of U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons development, you can call in 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And if we want to trace the history of U.S.-Russia arms control treaties, where do we start? The 1960s?
That's when we started talking. But do you mind if I just intercede
sure.
with a little bit of context? Because my guess is that almost all of your listeners have no idea how many nuclear weapons both sides have right now. Right now, the United States, and we're talking about nuclear weapons that are on land-based missiles, submarines, and bombers that have the range to strike Russia and Russian weapons that can strike the United States. Okay, the United States has about 2,100 and about another 2,500 in storage. Russia has about 2,600 and another 2,400 in storage. So two things are worth noting here. One, you know, if you want to, and there are military commands that do this, you could come up with a list of targets that under some circumstance you might want to hit with 2,000 nuclear weapons. By the way, a lot of these targets are the other side's nuclear weapons. So, you know, they kind of do cancel each other, I mean, while they're still in their silos, you know, as a preemptive attack. But it's hard to come up with these kinds of figures. Now, is this a lot? Russia has 2,600. U.S. has 2,000.
And those numbers are determined by treaty, right?
No, this is just what we have. They have been limited by treaty.
Yes.
But a lot of the biggest reduction came during George H.W. Bush's terms, and it was just because the Cold War was over. A lot of it was unilateral. Just let's get rid of a lot of this.
We had a lot more than 2,500 plus?
In 1967, which was the peak year, we had 31,000.
Wow.
Now, that included a lot of nuclear weapons in Europe and Asia, with short-range nuclear weapons. We even had nuclear artillery. Okay, in 1991, which was the last year of the Cold War, that had come down mainly on their own to 19,000. So now we're down to 2,000, you know, 4,500 if you count those in storage. It's a long ways down. But does it mean anything that the Russians have 500 more than we do? No. All that matters, and this is the thing when it comes to nuclear weapons, because it's not like, you know, these things go and hit each other in midair and whoever has the most left over wins.
Yeah.
No, it's, look, do we have enough weapons to deter the other side from using his first? Under the worst circumstances you can imagine, if they launched an attack, would we have enough left over to do devastating damage to them, to the point where they would be deterred from launching an attack in the first place? If we do, then and if we signal the determination, the technical ability and the will, as Dr. Strangelove might say, to actually do this, then it doesn't matter who has more. The Russians could build 10,000, 20,000 of these things. Waste your money. If we still had enough to say, okay, look, no matter what you do, we can strike back. We can retaliate in kind, as the phrase has it. Then these numbers, which, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, people discussed, like, you know, counting angels on a pin, these numbers don't mean a thing.
By that standard, we would only need two, let's say, nuclear warheads, right? I mean, if your standard is enough to retaliate and do immeasurable harm, create immeasurable destruction against the country that attacked us, then it's absurd to be talking about numbers of nuclear weapons in the thousands. It would literally be if we get through one or two or three.
Well, let me play nuclear strategist with you. This is the kind of thing that people used to do. Let's say the Russians launched a small attack on the United States, just to show they were serious. A small attack back in the Cold War, people would talk about hundreds of weapons. It's nuts. Let's say a couple dozen. Even that's nuts. But then they said, okay, hey, we've just knocked out your this, that, and the other thing, and we have all these other weapons behind us. Surrender now or we're going to destroy you even more. So you might argue, okay, well, I guess we would need the ability to play that game for a little while, to some extent. To make a very, very long story short, I've talked with people who actually have looked at the plans for this sort of thing. It's very hard to come up with "quote unquote" requirements for more than maybe 500 nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's very,
I guess
very
I was
hard.
Thinking of one nuclear weapon. One nuclear bomb leveled Hiroshima, one in Nagasaki.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, is that enough damage for you? And by the way, those were, by the standards of today's nuclear weapons, very small. You know, around 10 to 20 kilotons. Now we have weapons that are hundreds of kilotons, even some that are megatons. A kiloton being the equivalent of 1,000 tons of dynamite, plus, of course, the radiation, the fallout. There used to be, and I hope this doesn't come back, such a level of refined abstraction in the discussion of these things. I mean, you know, serious articles in magazines like Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy laying out scenarios where a Russian or an American leader rationally launches a couple of thousand nuclear missiles in the pursuit of playing some game of bargaining, sending signals. I mean, you know, by comparison, look at what's going on in the real world. We are alarmed that North Korea might have, what, 5, 6, maybe 10 nuclear bombs sometime soon? That's causing nervous wrecks out of people. We were alarmed when Iran seemed to be on the verge of making 1 or 2 nuclear weapons.
Right.
China has about 200 nuclear weapons. That's kept the Russians from attacking them for a long, long time. Israel has about the same number. And we're talking thousands, and we need to strengthen ourselves even more.
I want to get some calls in, but I want you to just give us a thought on where the current state of the treaties draws the line. Like, it starts in 1963 with a nuclear test ban treaty. I have this timeline in front of me.
Okay.
That banned the testing of nuclear missiles
in the atmosphere. Right.
1972, under Nixon, SALT I, anti-ballistic missile treaty, limited defenses. SALT II in 79, similar. There was the START I treaty in 1991, which reduced the number of delivery vehicles and warheads. Then there was START II in 1993, and the latest one was the 2010 START treaty, which again reduced the number of delivery vehicles and warheads. So what can we not even do, or do these treaties not matter?
Well, no, they mattered. I mean, the atmospheric test ban of 63, that was really more of an environmental treaty. Both sides, and in fact France and Britain and other countries too, used to test nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. Radiation spread. There were articles in the early 60s warning about levels of strontium-90 in your milk because of the fallout from nuclear tests in the Pacific. That ended. Now, part of the compromise that was drawn in negotiating that treaty was an intensification of nuclear tests underground. There were some attempts to ban those tests, too, but it didn't work out. Then in the ones you mentioned of the early Nixon treaties in 72, the first one, the SALT one, it set a limit of how many offensive nuclear weapons you could have, but it was way above the number that we already had. And in fact, Congress, the Senate, in exchange for ratifying this treaty, insisted that all subsequent administrations build up to the maximum level. So in some ways, the early offensive arms negotiation treaties actually spurred the production and deployment of nuclear weapons that might not otherwise have been approved. Now, but the one thing that was significant, and it lasted for a while, the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which banned defensive weapons, weapons that could shoot down offensive weapons. Now, you know, you might ask, what's wrong with a defensive weapon? What could possibly be wrong with that? Well, if, let's say, each side had a roughly equal number of weapons, and that created a standoff, and both sides were deterred. And then one side started building a weapon that could shoot down the other side's weapons, and built a lot of them
that's what Reagan wanted to do, the so-called Star Wars missile defense shield. And that is my understanding of what Putin was actually talking about this week. The way he wants to modernize Russia's nuclear arsenal now is so that it can penetrate anti-missile defenses.
Right, but in the 1950s and 60s, the U.S. was planning programs to do this that would have covered the entire United States. Now, they weren't going to work very well, but still, if you had that plus your offensive weapons, then the scenario would go, the United States could launch a first strike And then the Russian retaliation wouldn't be effective because we could absorb, we could shoot down all of their missiles. Therefore, we have nuclear superiority. And then what would happen is that both sides get into a ferocious offensive arms race to counter the other side's defenses. So the treaty in 1972 banned defensive weapons and put a big cap, a serious cap, on what could have been an explosive offensive arms race. All treaties have clauses which say, you know, any side can get out of this treaty for national security reasons with 6 months' notice. Bush did that upon entering office. He wanted to have a missile defense system. And now, the system that he wanted never got built because it really wasn't very good. The system that we do now have, we do have some in Europe. They actually, they're short range or medium range, they actually do not have, they're not positioned and they don't have the range to really do much about Russian nuclear weapons. They really are aimed mainly at things like Iran or North Korea. It's insane to think that a dozen or two of these things, even if they were effective, could nullify the Russian arsenal of 2,000 nuclear weapons. But, you know, he doesn't like it.
To be clear, the ABM treaty eventually expired, and
it didn't expire.
The attempt to replace but I thought there were the attempt to replace it with START II failed.
No. START II is just about all other nuclear weapons treaties have been about offensive weapons. The ABM treaty was a permanent treaty; it did not expire.
Okay.
The United States unilaterally pulled out of it when President Bush took office in 2001. We said we are withdrawing from this treaty. It is no longer in effect. If he hadn't done that, it would still be in force.
Because he wanted to build that kind of defensive missile shield.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, Reagan, I'm not sure about George W. Bush, offered to share that kind of missile shield with the Russians. The Russians at that time weren't interested. Why wouldn't both sides just go along with this? And if these are the two main nuclear powers, build a joint missile defense shield, and they would both be protected, if they work, and not have to worry about it.
Well, Ronald Reagan turns out to be a more interesting guy in this respect than many of us thought at the time. His aides were in favor of doing Star Wars because, A, it would be a big propaganda tool. Hey, we're just trying to prevent nuclear war and the Russians don't want us to. B, if it worked, which actually very few people thought it would counter Russian offensive weapons and thus give us a boost for nuclear superiority, whatever that means. But it turns out Reagan really believed his own rhetoric. He was a secret nuclear abolitionist. He wanted nuclear weapons to be put to rest. And when he and Gorbachev met in Reykjavik, Iceland, he offered a deal. He goes, look, and he did this behind the backs of his advisors, most of whom were appalled. He said, look, let's get rid of all of these nuclear weapons and share Star Wars. And Gorbachev said, no, you can't have Star Wars. And he said, no, we have to have Star Wars. And the talks collapsed. But he wanted to get rid of all of them. Here's the thing. Look, the Cold War was still going on. Mm-hmm. If I said to you, here, I have a weapon that can really do, it can wipe out your retaliatory force, but here, I'm going to share it. Let's share it. Are you really going to trust that he's going to share everything about it with you? I mean, in the context, it didn't make sense. So the good news, the only two people who really believed that Star Wars would work were Reagan and a lot of people working for Gorbachev. It probably really did have an impact on the Soviet decision to throw in the towel. They thought that we really had something here.
George in Yonkers, you're on WNYC with Fred Kaplan, War Stories columnist from Slate. Hi, George.
Hello. I recently heard news reports about the Obama administration wanting to set aside about $1 trillion in future spending to improve our nuclear arsenal. How is his plans any different than President-elect Trump's?
Well, we don't know what Trump's plan is. It's not $1 trillion. If it really did play out over a 10-year period, it would be about $370 billion. Even it's not clear. I mean, look, there are two ways to look at, quote, nuclear modernization, unquote. One of them is going on all the time. It's making sure the stuff works, testing the mechanical parts, keeping the nuclear labs going, keeping up the production of tritium, that kind of, improving command control mechanisms. But there are plans to build new land-based missiles, new submarine missiles, new submarines, because, you know, they don't last forever, a new generation of bombers, new cruise missiles. None of these are even in development. I mean, this new land-based intercontinental ballistic missile, if we proceeded with the plans to actually build it, it would be fielded in the year 2028. The new submarine, the year 2031. A new bomber in the late 2020s. So these programs, it's not like, you know, a program in active production at all. In terms of building new weapons, new nuclear weapons, we haven't done anything for years. Why? Because there's no need to. I mean, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, we have bombers that are older than the pilots that fly them. Well, that's true, but, you know, that's like, you know, you might have a car that's older than you, too. Probably there isn't a single part in your car that's original, you know, these classic cars. Everything has been replaced in these things. It's you know, even the chassis. So everything, you know, Trump has given speeches in the past saying that our nuclear arsenal is in disrepair. It's atrophied. This is nonsense. It's not true at all.
Edward in Birmingham, Alabama. You're on WNYC. Hello from New York, Edward.
Oh, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm sure. A big fan of your show.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. This is getting to a level of abstraction. I thought maybe we start talking about throw weight or something.
Oh, my God. We have an old timer on the phone.
Throw weight? Is that a nuclear vocabulary term I should know?
Yeah, we'll explain it.
All right. Edward, go ahead.
Or is that all? You just want to talk about throw weight?
No. I'm telling Edward to go ahead. No, Edward, go ahead.
Well, I have a fairly simple question. One that gets asked all the time, but I don't know how well the answer is known, which is, what is the actual procedure if our new president-elect, or any president for that matter, sort of decides that it would make his day to launch a missile? What kind of procedure is there, and what kind of barriers are there?
Right, because we know the president has the final authority, and I believe only the president has the final authority to launch a nuclear weapon. Edward, you want to know, if Trump were to be, like, out of his mind and want to do this, what constraints are there on him? Is that basically your question?
Essentially, yeah.
Okay, good. We don't have to talk about throw it then.
Right, good.
Unless you're curious.
No,
but,
not that curious.
Well, the precise procedures are, you know, they're not completely known to people like us for good reason. But generally speaking, I mean, the president does have the ultimate authority to just decide to do this. Now, when he has this thing that's in what they call the suitcase or the football, and it's got his, you know, he can put his hand on it, he punches certain codes. Now, does that directly launch the missiles? Is there actually a line between this box and all the missile silos and bomber commands? No. It would go through what's called the National Military Command Center, which the Secretary of Defense would have some, at least he would be supposed to salute and pass on the signal to the head of Strategic Command, which then has operational control of these things. There's an interesting story. I think it was in Woodward and Bernstein's The Final Days, I think, that, you know, in Nixon's final days, when he was looking a little loopy, Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger put out an order to all the Joint Chiefs, to the Chiefs of Staff, maybe to the head of Strategic Air Command, too, saying, if the president gives you some nutty order, call me first, which is kind of interesting. I mean, it suggests that maybe if the president did this out of sheer nuttiness, someone like the Secretary of Defense could. It's not. It's not like, you know, you're sitting at home with your remote control and you push a button and on comes the television. It goes through channels, and the channels are supposed to obey unthinkingly. But, you know, it's would it really work that way?
Well, we're going to.
It depends on the circumstances, I would say. Also, there are provisions, you know, in case Washington is blown up and the president is no longer alive. There are provisions for command authority. And that's how, you know, that's what Dr. Strangelove was about, right? That, you know, he General Jack D. Ripper put out, you know, execute code R, which suggested that Washington was leveled. And so he had the authority. Interestingly about Dr. Strangelove, at the time that that movie was written, the procedures that are depicted in that movie were the actual procedures.
Huh. I can't believe Trump hasn't even been inaugurated yet, and we're already talking about Dr. Strangelove. I think somebody said, I seem to remember somebody
talk about Dr. Strangelove.
Somebody asking a few months ago, would you trust the nuclear codes to a man who could be baited with a tweet? What we didn't realize was that the tweets were going to be about the nuclear codes. So.
Yeah.
For now, we leave it there with Fred Kaplan, War Stories columnist for Slate. Among his books was one about U.S.-Russia nuclear relationships called The Wizards of Armageddon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.